Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
Right, on the beat, obviously, on the metronome, you know.
Well, I had to wait a second because a bus just went by, and I wanted to give you some some bus white noise.
Yeah, it's that California traffic, I can see.
Uh-huh.
This is what I've been putting up with for 10 fucking years, you believe this?
Bullshit. No, it's nice, I like it. For now.
I am former Silicon Valley resident, Eric 13, and I am here with current San Francisco inhabitant, Michael Kester.
Coming to you live from 3 hours before Eric is coming to you.
That's great.
And this is
We got on to do sound check, and the first thing you did is complain about the traffic. And I'm just
there's
like,
there's a bus
yes.
outside my fucking door. It's a bus outside my window. So I'm here. We talked a little bit last week about how I was going to be vacating the great state of Texas. And
we got a California free like 2 weeks of the show.
Yeah.
And now we're back in
the prison state of California. It's interesting though, because I think one of the tones that's going to change, Charles, you're going to love this. One of the tones that's going to change is that I don't have the love for like the California like lefty stuff yet.
Oh, yeah.
Because I just came from Texas. And you and I don't know if we've talked as much on the air, but we have talked a little bit off the air about how you and I were right in line with each other in Chicago politically.
Full harmony.
Very much, yeah. And then I moved to a red state and you moved to a blue state. And not to say that like I went like full Trump thumping, but like we definitely diverged slightly, and I emphasis on slightly, but enough for me to hate the bullshit that is in California now that I'm here.
Okay, well, that's how you want to go there, primed to hate what's in California.
I feel like it took you a solid like 3 years before you were going, Gavin, but I'm fucking Gavin day one.
Well, that's that accelerated corona timing. That's what that is.
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what's changed, we should talk about this on the show really, because what's changed wasn't really our personal politics, maybe not at all, but more our perception of the world and sort of like where I think you and I have the most radical shifts is like a thing will have one of these fucking events, news alert on your phone, boom, news alert, boom, news alert. And we'll both look at it and I'll be like, oh, so obviously this is going to happen. And you'll be like, what the fuck are you talking about? No way, this is what happens.
Right, right.
I'll get a text from you, like a thing will be on the news. I'll get a text from you and you're like, how many days till this and this? I'm like, not on planet Earth, buddy.
Right.
And yeah, I don't know if our politics are really different at all. I think if you gave us
I think you're right. I think
a
that's,
sheet of things to vote on, we'd probably.
Yeah, no, I think you're dead on.
Although since moving to New York, I'm full embrace chaos. That's just. I'm curious to see if this softens you up. I am.
I feel like it might do the opposite. I feel like I'm just going to be, it's going to be abrasion rubbing against abrasion, and we're going to get a more abrasive surface.
All right. Well, the reason we're talking about all of this is because we have a special San Francisco-centric episode.
That's right.
Of Double Feature today.
It's a San Francisco treat, right? This double feature is what is known as the San Francisco treat, right?
Yeah, that's what they're talking about. That's what they've been building up to this whole time.
So the two movies today, we're doing an old exploitation movie called Bullet. And then we're doing a really interesting movie. Can't wait to talk to you about this in approximately 24 minutes after spoiling Bullet. The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Newer film. And no matter if you have not seen The Last Black Man in San Francisco, I'm just going to prime you. I know it's already the show, but if you haven't seen The Last Black Man in San Francisco, it is not what you're expecting. Don't know what you're expecting, but it is not that movie.
You know what it is? It's probably a movie for the type of person who listens to this show.
Right.
It's very like theme rich, but so weird. It takes some unlocking to...
I'm actually really excited. I don't want to jump the gun on Bullet here,
all
but...
Right, all right.
I'm excited to talk to you about it because I have some
big thoughts.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the Patreon?
Yes, I want to talk about the Patreon. It's at patreon.com/doublefeature. And this is my entire look at the Patreon at this point. We used to come on here, we'd say things like, oh, get the entire back catalog, 600 plus something right. fucking show, all of that. That's great. It's on there.
Right.
But at this point, and maybe this is like me starting to embrace the culture post moving to New York episode mm-hmm. of the show, but I just feel like in the society we live in today, if you don't support the things you love, they'll die on the vine, and that's just it.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's room for giant corporate mega things, but like, guys, open the fucking podcast app. What's in there? Mega right-wing shows
right.
that are selling diet pills and true crime podcasts, many of which I subscribe to, but all are owned by Viacom.
Right.
The podcast app is just Viacom app.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these shows are, you know, you basically have to be super corporate to garner any kind of audience. And it's really, really hard to get your voice heard if you're not. And I feel like right now we don't have cinemas. We don't have, you know, fucking Sundance is digital right now. We're going to talk about a great movie that Sundance brought us and Last Black Man in San Francisco. So much of this is digital now. We have to keep these hubs together of where people come to talk about movies. And my favorite thing of doing the show for really the entire time we've been doing it is hearing from people, planning the schedule with people, and knowing that people are out there listening to this, having a little bit of that community that has been stripped from all of us. So that's my only plea on the Patreon from now on. All I want to do is like,
yeah.
come join the community.
I was going to try and talk about the like triple city feature additional content, but that seems small now, so I'll just hit it at the end. I'll just come back around to it.
Yeah, there'll be some more talking about cities on the Patreon, but mostly just come be part of this. You know, you're hearing the show already. You've done the hard work. You found us amongst all this fucking noise that's out there. Come over on the Patreon and let's just band together and keep this show going. Bullet.
So have you seen Bullet before today?
I had not. This is okay. a rainy day film.
Good.
Which I use in the rare occasion that I need to be propelled out of depression. So I'm glad we hit this red button.
Let me like set up the logline conversation here. So I have seen Bullet a total of 3 times. The most recent time is for today's episode of Double Feature. Before this conversation, this one you and I are having right now, mm-hmm. if you asked me what happened in the movie Bullet, I wouldn't have an answer.
Yeah.
Much like what seems like the entirety of society, Bullet to me was a green car with a black car in a chase scene.
Well, it's crazy because you even introduced it as roadsploitation or an exploitation film.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, what happens in Bullet, I think, is that we, and I didn't want to step over what you were talking about here. So let me know and we'll wait on the log line if we need to take a beat here. Yeah, what happens in Bullet is there's this great kind of mystery and intrigue that drives it along. And then there's this car chase that just destroys all of that.
Yeah.
In your memory anyways. I mean, it's still there. It's not as if the movie doesn't completely resolve all of it. In a great way, it just comes together seamlessly, but the chase is so big and iconic
right.
that in your head it just becomes like, oh yeah, that movie about that 11-minute car chase.
Well, and that's the thing, right? So like you mentioned, because last week I called this a roadsploitation movie. This movie, I just shortened it to sploitation. But yeah, in my mind, it's the green Camaro and the Charger. Which once I know the names of cars, it's a roadsploitation movie. If I've done that research, but what
also you picked your 1968 cars.
Yeah. But what I what I don't recall or didn't recall until today is that this is actually like sort of like a kind of like a hard noir movie.
Yeah.
The other thing I didn't recall was like the like Robert Vaughn, basically the fact that they got two out of the Magnificent Seven to come and do these powerhouse fucking like warring behemoth roles, you know, because that's how this movie feels to me now. The first two times it was two cars pitted against each other on the San Francisco hills. And now it's two fucking forces of nature in Robert Vaughn, who plays the politician, and Steve McQueen, who plays the bullet. And that is now when I return to Bullet for the fourth time, maybe it will not be for the car chase scene anymore.
Yeah.
It's funny because you'd think, having moved to San Francisco, watching cars go fast in my own city, especially with like the hills and shit that I'm walking up and down every day going, man, it'd be super cool for cars to go fast down here. And then I see it and I'm just like, I just kind of want to hang out with like Steve McQueen and watch him fuck off Robert Vaughn.
Yeah, that makes me want to dive into the Steve McQueen of it all. We should do the log line proper. I'm going to try and exert some self-control here. Hit it at the top. Well, we've already failed in that. Hit it at the middle. Yeah, let's talk about the kind of wild plot of this. So I want to, you know what I actually want to do is just talk to you about the whole thing, because it's something that once again in our logline exercises we haven't seen. So you can build an inciting incident when you're just trying to give this sort of setup pitch of this movie. In this movie, Steve McQueen's character Bullet has to babysit this guy. He's really important key witness at this. It's not even a trial, right? Because of the senator. It's like a Senate hearing, Senate committee, but it's about Chicago crime.
Mm-hmm.
Also a great part of this movie that there's so much Chicago and it's so one, perfect for today's double feature, welcoming you to San Francisco.
Right.
But also this is almost like a side quest of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, here's what's going on in the Bullet cinematic universe.
Right.
We're finally going to take down the kingpin of Chicago crime. And so we've got this big trial and there's going to be a bunch of witnesses, this one key witness. And so it's like a story about taking down a Chicago crime boss. But what we're actually doing in our movie here, this is like the side movie. This is the spinoff. We just have this one night we were supposed to protect a witness. And it goes like fucking catastrophically wrong. And I mean, just, you know, they basically, he's sent there to babysit this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, don't let the guy out, you know, don't let him talk to anybody. Don't we want to just keep our witness locked down? And if you can avoid it, definitely make sure he doesn't get shotgunned in the face. That would be like, you really don't want that to happen.
Sure.
So it just goes, it goes as wrong as it could. And then the movie is about unraveling, well, I feel like something's going on here, though. I got to get to the bot. That's the noir-y kind of part.
Yeah, and there's these aspects that the movie does that, again, you know, so I've seen this movie three times. And it wasn't until this time I could really tell you what happened. So I didn't know the thing. I didn't know the thing.
Oh, the doppelganger element.
Yeah.
I
just didn't know it. I just didn't recall it.
Yeah.
But there's like these little breadcrumbs. Are we getting too far away from dropping the log line?
Well, I was sort of doing the IKEA assemble at home yourself version of the log line here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I suppose it's like when his babysitting job goes catastrophically wrong,
mm-hmm.
Bullet must track down the truth wherever it may lead.
Great.
Something like that, right? Sort of.
That sounds good.
Oh, his friends might be foes. We don't know how deep the rabbit hole goes. I gotta race through the night, you know, that kind of stuff.
So yeah.
Except.
Uh-huh.
If I may.
Please.
Well, so what's wild about it is our inciting incident then is they're supposed to protect this witness and he dies.
Yeah.
He's dead. They fucked up. It's over. Except you find out later in the movie that he's not dead and what the sort of like vague, oh, solving the mystery ends up being about is their witness wasn't the guy who was killed. Their witness is still out in the world. They could still,
right.
They could still get the witness and bring him to the trial. So it's kind of like the inciting incident being that this key piece they needed for the trial is now gone. It sort of offers a second chance, and I don't think we've seen that yet.
Kind of.
Hypothetically.
I do want to say that when pseudo Ross, faux Ross, gets murdered,
mm-hmm.
there's all these things about, like, who put you in this room? Why are you so close to the highway? What's going on? This is the worst hotel room. And right. they go, well, you know, the guy that hired you put me here. And you go, okay, so this is actually a frame job, and they're trying to get this guy killed for some reason. And so immediately you start suspecting pretty much everybody but the guy who gets murdered.
Yeah.
Who is actually, you know, in a weird way, the person you should be suspecting. Not the actual physical guy, but Ross. You should be suspecting Ross. But back to what you're saying is by the time the big thing unravels, you know, so much of this movie is pulling at these loose threads,
mm-hmm.
not only to have them lead to nowhere, because that's not how this movie goes. It's Bullet pulling at loose threads until the end of the thread is murdered and he has to move on to a different thread.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's what happens. He goes, okay, so I'm doing a thing. And then faux Ross gets murdered. And he's like, okay, well, let's go find the guys who murdered him. And then they murder themselves. And then he's like, okay, well, everybody's been murdered. Except, oh shit, wait, you're telling me Ross is, okay, I'm going to murder that guy.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, that's crazy. That's the thing that makes the movie have this kind of sad when you think about it ending. I mean, I think you feel it when you get there. It's very, it's just very somber. There's a lot of long goodbye kind of happening in this movie, but it's, you know, the guy that, wait a second. He's not really dead. He's alive. We can, oh no, now he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
There's like this brief moment of, oh, we got to track this guy down. We can't let him leave. And then he just dies anyways, which is also a huge bummer.
One of the things, and you and I have talked about Steve McQueen at least once or twice on the show. We did Papillon. I think that was an AC episode, but we did do that. The
no, we did it in the main show, yeah.
It was main show. Yeah, yeah. Okay, cool. Oh, but somebody else suggested it. That's what it was.
Yes.
Patreon.com/double feature. But the thing about Steve McQueen for me is that it is, I'm going to go with literally impossible to not root for him in any role. He has sort of this magnetic charisma where you want him to come out on top. And so this movie sort of utilizes that and predicates this character on having this reputation of getting, you know, getting results.
Yeah.
And to see him be robbed of that at the beginning of the movie, there's really nothing other than Steve McQueen's presence and possibly performance that makes you want him to figure out, makes you want him to figure out a way to win. Because the audience should be viewing this as he done fucked up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because for whatever...
Instead, only I view it that way.
Right. Well, comically and you and so. Robert, you and Robert Vaughn.
Yes.
Who is actually one of the major protagonists in the film, but is somehow painted as the big bad.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you see him follow these threads, like I was saying, and finally get to the point where he has that chance to go, you guys were all wrong. I knew there was something up. I've got the guy right in front of me and he just fucking has to shoot him. We're not even talking about like police brutality. We are flat out talking like that guy shot one cop and then turned around.
Yeah.
With a gun in his hand.
Yeah.
He's just going to shoot the next cop.
Well, yeah, there's an element to a lot of these movies. I mean, you really tapped into it talking about noir, but feel, you know, when we got that first wave of like 70s neo-noir, or, you know, I mean, this is 68 and feels just as much like it. There's our good old friend nihilism has reared its head on the show once again. There's sort of a clusterfuck element to a lot of these films where you go through this odyssey, you know, this very, I feel like these movies are always in Los Angeles that do this, but this kind of Chinatown-like odyssey, and then you wind up instead out the other end kind of going, what was it all for? And I think thematically, that's a big part of the character and his relationship is, you know, being married to this thing, this chase, this solving the mystery, and where does it leave him? It also kind of reminds me of like Manhunter, you know, just we've seen this so many times, this all-consuming nature of the job, but really here with like an especially poignant, and you did this for what? But yeah, I know what you mean about Steve McQueen, because it's, you know, there's a lot of, I don't know that I'd say like powerhouse household name people, but Peter Yates is an interesting character, the director of the film. Like, he was a professional race car driver. You know, if you ever hear him talk about the film, he has this obsession with like how fucking fast the cars have to go. The only other time I think you and I really talked about one of his films is Crawl. So it's kind of a weird...
Wow, okay.
Like, it's just, yeah, just a thing.
It does still have
a speed element? I don't know.
I mean...
There's a narcotic joke in here I just can't find. Yeah, but that, you know, that infamous scene, like people talk about the editing of it. Obviously, Peter Yates gets credit for it. But this is a William Fraker movie. He was the cinematographer. He shot like Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
You know, these movies that are very like...
That checks out.
Movies
with foregrounds is just dumb it down.
Understated kind of nuance to the camera work. But he's also a really interesting guy to hear him talk about cinematography. So much of what's important about this movie is not the angle we took in talking the plot that gets overlooked so often, but really is the like, why do I feel it? Why does this movie connect in a visceral way? And these are the people behind it. And yet even shining, I would say it's fair to say, you know, outshining them is Steve McQueen. He has this, I don't know, he just came from that era, especially where people would go, oh, have you seen Steve McQueen's Bullet? You know, He is the action star central to the guys who like Steve McQueen. Go see Steve McQueen's Bullet. Cars go fast. You know, he just has this star power to him. So I know what you mean about that. I also think for us today, that long chase is so characteristic of San Francisco. You know, the hills, especially just feeling that going over. Like, I don't know if there's anywhere in cinema that's ever made me feel like when I would have to take a car to just go park anywhere in the city.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be doing 100 miles an hour to feel that. You could be doing 20 over those hills and you're just like, there's no way I'm not going to comically plow through six rows of pedestrians as my car flies off a cliff.
Well, and I've seen Bullet described as a movie that, while it has Steve McQueen in it, it stars San Francisco, which I don't actually agree with.
I don't either, but you know, like this one? The sort of in the streets nature of it was a big part of how they filmed it, you know, with these, the sort of Danny Boyle-esque, like we have ultralight cameras, we're rigging things to cars, we need to use actual speed. But I think part of that is because they spend so much time on interiors. So it's just kind of like, well, yes, but this could be inside any house rather than on the streets. But, you know, when it counts, when they're doing the chase and stuff, it's pretty unforgettable and pretty San Francisco. On a normal episode of the show, I would also feel the need to talk about like red tape and sidestepping it thematically and whatever, but that's... Look, we have more SF to do here.
Sure.
Michael, you are living in a sewer. Let's move on to the next movie.
Hold on. If you're trying to figure out which one of these movies to talk about sidestepping red tape, let me introduce you to a film called The Last Black Man in San Francisco. A film about squatters' rights.
Something like that.
Yeah, so I said earlier in the show that there was sort of like this big thing that I wanted to mention with this movie, and it is this. I haven't, and maybe I'm wrong. We are 3 hours apart, so a lot could have changed. But I don't know that I have seen in my time on Double Feature a movie that I feel like I would point at this movie when someone was, if someone were to be like, okay, so you and your co-host on Double Feature, like, what is one movie that combines the most idiosyncratic details of your film preferences? Not necessarily our favorites, but the most idiosyncratic details of the things we like in film. And I now have a film to point to, because never in my life have I seen a movie that was like if Shane Carruth directed Wrong.
Dude, I was going to say Yorgos. I mean, yeah, there is an occasional like, yeah, Yorgos level or really whoever level of weird. Wrong is another good pull out. But you know what else is crazy is you on occasion will watch this movie and wonder what the rules of the world even are, as if it's so surreal.
Right.
But then on other occasions, you're like, wait, nothing surreal. This is just San Francisco.
I know.
And this is how it is.
You close one eye and you're watching The Lobster, and you close the other eye and you're watching Moonlight.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the scene, the scene that's jumping to mind right now is when he sees his mom on the bus. This is a perfect example of this. So there's this scene where he's on the bus. There's a dog that's eating what might be a dead hippie. And then it cuts away from this because a woman sits down across from him. And then you get the idea that this woman knows him, and you go, okay, so they must know each other. Only for it to be revealed that this woman is none other than the main character's mom. And then they proceed to talk like coworkers three jobs ago.
Uh-huh.
And immediately both go through painstaking hurdles to try and end the conversation as quickly as possible. And this is that moment, right? Because if this were Dogtooth, there would be some sort of acceptance where you would go, well, you know, things are kind of weird, so I guess that's just like how these people relate.
Yeah.
But they're not from here. They're from another type of world. But sort of like you're saying, by the time we get off the bus, and the film sort of knows it's doing this because you get off the bus into like a fucking third world country bomb site where everything is smoking. And I'm sitting here going, is this the fog from San Francisco? Or is this the fog from John Carpenter's The Fog? Or is it Children of Men?
Well, and it's all, even now talking about that scene, it's sort of like by the time the smoke cleared, I sort of went, oh, I know what's happening. But now that I look back, I'm like, why was it smoky? Is that metaphorical smoke?
Right.
Was it, you know what I mean? So there's even still details. Like it does have a kind of a puzzle nature to it in that it is asking you to, you know, it's engaging with you. That's why I love movies like this, because they really do go, okay, sit down. We're going to do this together, you and I. You got to figure this out.
Right.
And then it ends up not being like preposterously hard or anything. You can at least walk away from the movie. I mean, not even just understanding all the narrative, but really getting what it, you know, the heart of what it was talking about too.
I think that is actually what the movie is doing. I think that we are seeing a David Lynchian effort to go, just ignore what's going on and pay attention to what I'm telling you.
Yeah.
That's what the movie is really getting at the whole time. Because if I were to sit here and go, okay, so let me tell you the plot of The Last Black Man in San Francisco. A young man is obsessed with this home that was built by his grandfather, only to find out that it has been vacated. And he and his friend decide to move in there and move in there while it is unoccupied and live as though it is their home, only to be struggling to keep this house in their life.
Forces of the world conspiring against them.
Sure.
You know, there's another like, there's an immediate returning home kind of element of
it. And this is kind of what I'm saying about the ignore what the movie is doing and just listen to what it's telling you, because the whole movie goes, this house is important. My grandfather built it. I gotta paint the windowsill. I feel fulfilled inside of it. But when he's inside the house, he's not really doing anything of import to his own life.
Sure.
It's almost as if, bear with me, it's almost as if the house has become this thing he's put on a pedestal. And once he has achieved the house, in quotation marks, he's actually entirely got nothing else to be fulfilled by. Maybe that's good. Maybe he's reached enlightenment. Until the movie goes ahead and tells you that the house is one giant fucking MacGuffin. It is the biggest golden briefcase that we've seen in cinema. And it's just this thing that he decided was important. And it's actually not even metaphorically meaningful for anything other than him to put it in front of his actual needs.
Yeah, well, it speaks to a, God, man, like any truly great film, the amount of things that thematically, like the fucking tree branches are crazy. The directions you can go, like, I didn't even think about this sitting down to watch the film, but as you put it like that, I start thinking about how we create these things that are important to us. They have no real, you know, meaning. They're not tied down to anything. We just fucking decide that whatever little obsessions are, I have like 30 of these. I have lists of books I'm trying to get through, lists of movies that I get so important that I see like these 20 films for whatever fucking reason. You know, things you kind of start on a lark and then they become like part of your fucking identity. And that's just who we are as humans. We get wrapped up in things.
Mm-hmm.
It's why movies even work.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that just on today's show, I think is actually kind of poignant, as you mentioned, you know, playfully that you were like super depressed and like Bullet was this rainy day thing. Well, since we're not on the Bullet segment of the show, I can say this, but like, is it that big of a deal?
What do you mean?
Can you, I mean, imagine you have put, I mean, listen, I'm sorry to like put you in the spot, but you know, and we can just play this, you know, theoretically, but Bullet, the movie Bullet, okay, take the movie Bullet. Is that something that you would prescribe to somebody with depression?
No, of course not. No.
Yeah, exactly. But you have given it this weight as a what you and I will call a rainy day film.
Well, I hadn't even seen it. I didn't even know.
And
I
suddenly,
would enjoy it. I'm just like, I'll save.
And
this
that's what I mean. But it doesn't matter
when
because,
I need it.
Because even if you don't like it, there's like this endorphin rush because you have assigned it to this arbitrary piece of art.
It's like a little piece of dessert you get for yourself or something, a package you order. Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
It's like a reward.
Yeah, it's why video games work too. I mean, it's the same thing. We're just like, oh, but this Pokemon,
right?
This is the one I truly need and then I'll be happy.
Sure. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, this movie has, it also has a kind of like Renaissance painting quality to it that I think adds to that enigma. But the more you think about it, the more it's very fulfilling in these things that normally I'm kind of like, okay, well, why does Yorgos do the things he does? You mentioned David Lynch. Any filmmaker that dabbles in the surreal or the enigmatic, I feel bad even, you know, mentioning Sorry to Bother You.
Mm-hmm.
But God, I can't help thinking about that surreal world that they build as well. But in this movie, I mean, he's got this group of guys that stand outside the house. You know, they have like a Greek chorus sort of. They feel like they're from, you know, a 300 BC play or something.
Well, the movie is so elusive in so many ways. Mm. There's so much of the movie that isn't important, again, to the story, but is important to what the movie is doing. You know, how the Mont has to essentially like act like he's a harder version of himself in order to just like invite this guy over to the house. But why? Like, why does this person need to come over? And in that moment, you know, I'm sitting there trying to unpack, you know, why. To me, if this were one of the normal movies I watched, then yeah, I mean, I know why you invite him over and you fucking eat him or whatever, but that's not this movie. And, you know, you find out that, I've forgotten his name, but the lead character was in a boys' home with this character. And so that's the big reveal. And you think like, okay, so from an expositional standpoint, that is sort of a device to bring that information out. But that's not what it's actually doing. What it's doing is actually telling you that Mont has sort of like a fixer complex. And he's like appealed to these boys' home kids. You know, he says that like he used to be that way and has since been like brought out of it in a way.
Yeah.
And then you start thinking, you know, then it feels sort of like a Taoist, like Buddhist allegory.
Sure.
About like one at a time enlightening these people who don't belong to make them more San Franciscan.
Well, yeah, you know also, what I mean? Like, it's just, God, we are making this movie sound way harder than it is, you know, like way less. It just sounds so fucking pretentious, doesn't it? But it does.
It is, but...
but then, like, you also look at it, and the color and the light, the look of this movie, it just looks so expertly made. Him on the boat. I mean, just so much of this stills as paintings, quality of it, the number of things that it talks about. I mean, I'm just, I'm like crazy fucking impressed with this movie. You know, thematically, like, gentrification is huge. We're talking about the changing world, especially with the contrast of him like trying to return home in a place that is constantly changing. We're talking about outsiders. The way the movie talks about outsiders, I love, because there's a conversation we saw a little bit in Blindspotting, actually quite a bit in Blindspotting, which is...
Stop naming San Francisco movies.
That's an Oakland movie. So it's, you know, if I'm going to be honest with you about my San Francisco experience, it's like, you know, HBO's Silicon Valley meets Blindspotting. That was sort of the... I didn't spend a lot of time in the city proper.
It's $6 to get to San Francisco from Oakland. It's not worth it.
Who is that? You got to pick one.
In this economy?
Oh, my God. I'm kidding, though. Pro Oakland. But, you know, there's a huge conversation that happens in San Francisco about outsiders, because it is such a... I mean, both of the places we moved are key locations for a national conversation about gentrification. They just, you know, New York and San Francisco. And in San Francisco's case, so much of it is tech and the huge money that comes there and the startups. And the nature of the startup is young people with big ideas who've moved somewhere to be, you know, it's just like the opposite of like born and raised here, which is so much of what's in this movie. And I think when it shows outsiders, you know, you think about a scene like on the fucking Segways. Like, to me, that is extremely quintessential San Francisco's people, like on a fucking Segway tour. And how it sort of treats the back and forth. You know, in that scene, him being like, no, my grandfather built this place, and he gives the thing. And then like, man, what a double meaning that whole scene takes on once you get to the end of the film. And then, you know, you go back, you see the movie again. And it's like, oh, fuck, this is all, you know, like the story's wrong, basically, but the feeling is true. You know, and we see that again and again where the movie addresses feelings over logistics. It's putting you in a character's point of view rather than, because really, like, what are the logistics of this movie? You know, we fight and fight for this guy who's essentially just like going to a house that he doesn't live at and then eventually moving into it. And we feel fucking burned when they basically won't gift him the house, you know?
Right.
Like he tries to go get a free $4 million house and everybody shoots him down. And you're like, damn, life is just not fair. But like, what? How else would you resolve any of the, you know, if this were about logistics, who did the wrong thing? Or should they not put the house on the market?
Let's not forget how much the movie mocks you for wanting that, though. Also,
what do you mean?
There's that smash cut where he's at the bank and he's like, dude, can I please have $4 million? I really, really promise that I will never miss a payment ever, even if you charge me more than I can afford. I promise I'll be able to pay for it. And the guy's like, no, I can't. And he's like, please, you can bend me over a barrel and fuck me in the ass. And then the next audio you hear is, okay, great. Sounds good. You got me, you charming softy.
But then
it smash cuts to just the realtor on the phone with his fucking friend. And then he hangs up the phone. He goes, anyway, what? You want me to give you a house? Fuck you.
It's something that as a visual storyteller, I love that stuff. I love emphasizing feeling over plot points, logistics, morality, who is truly correct. Because as you go through life, so much of the conflict you experience is not about you were objectively right and they were objectively wrong and everyone's unfair to you. It's a lot of misunderstandings. It's a lot of miscommunication. It's a lot of people fighting for different ends because they think they're right. And that doesn't help how you feel. Even if you decide later you're wrong on all those accounts, it's still brutal when you try to achieve something and you can't. When you try to get a $4 million house and you can't because you grew up there, you know, because you have fond memories of it, because you've told yourself that this is what's
right,
important to make you feel good. And the movie is so good about getting us to that place too, where we are fighting for these same things, especially difficult in a movie where sometimes we're not even sure if the rules of their world operate the way, if their up is our up and if their down is our down, you know, or if they're in some surreal fucking nightmare world, some strange Wes Anderson prison, you know. But the other thing I was going to say about Outsiders is the scene with the naked man on the bench. You think about that against the segue. I guess that's where I was going with that. Sorry. But you think about that against the segue people. Like a bunch of people on a segue are fucked up. But this guy sitting naked on the bench is just like, this is part of my world. This is what the real San Francisco's like. This guy can sit here and I'm going to just talk to him like this is normal.
Right.
You know, because the outsiders feel weird. That's what's truly weird in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And naked dude on a bench is like quintessential San Francisco normal.
That was the scene that made me think of the version of San Francisco that I had expected to find here. Is a disenfranchised black man and a probably homeless or nearly homeless, like, sexual deviant, but like without a negative connotation.
Yeah.
Chilling on a bench together, getting shouted at by frat boys on a trolley. One of the things that I always think about when I see one of these trolleys is I had a friend back in Chicago and he was gay. And I was talking about party. Remember the party trolley in Chicago? There was just like a bus that looked like a trolley and like it had like.
No.
Flashing lights. It literally just like drove in circles around Wrigleyville.
Well, that solves that mystery.
But I called it.
Why didn't Eric know about the party trolley?
Yeah. So I called it the party trolley. I called it the party trolley once to my friend. And he's like, what's the party trolley? And I'm like, you know, the like bus that's like flashing. He's like, oh, is it that thing where like guys drive around and call other guys on the street faggots? And I was like,
sure, of course.
Yes, that's the thing. That sort of like candor that he had where he was like, I'm a gay guy living in. So anybody who doesn't know the geography of Chicago, Boys Town, which is the gayborhood, is right next to Wrigley Field, which is Wrigleyville, which is the big like bro-y party neighborhood.
And a cruel twist of fate.
Right.
Poor city planning in Chicago. So
my friend is sort of the soil of Chicago in that neighborhood. And yet these intruders parade through, pay gobs of money to parade through and point at them like it's fucking Jurassic Park. And that moment in Last Black Man in San Francisco, where these fucking, this bus full of date rapers points at these two guys like, this is fucking crazy. When the reality is, from where those two guys are sitting, they are not the animals.
I am so glad we're getting movies that talk about this stuff. It's so crazy to me. People look at these as these like niche films, when in reality, most people live in giant fucking cities, just demographically speaking in the United States. And any city, any CITY city in the US has these problems, has problems around gentrification, around the larger city being divided into smaller cities and neighborhoods, around outsiders coming in. You know, there has been a national thrust towards, you know, people get the fuck out of the suburbs. They grow up in the suburbs young. They get the fuck out of the suburbs. They go to the city. So the city's constantly got new neighborhoods in it. And, you know, what's available to cinema, the people who fund movies just treat it like, no one's going to relate to this stuff. these are super niche films. No one will understand what you're talking about. There's no audience. And in reality, I identified with so much in this movie, not just in my time here in New York, not just when I was in California, but fucking in Chicago too. I mean, it's basically everywhere I've lived that wasn't, you know, the small town of 100,000 people has problems like this. And we get plenty of the other stuff. We need more movies that talk about, I don't even want to call them modern problems, because this is, I don't know, I don't want to go into a whole thing about living out here, but it's like, but this, you know, this didn't start with tech, right? This didn't start with, and tech has also been there for just as long as Bullet has, and wasn't a, you know, a fixture in a movie like that. So I won't even say that, you know, we need modern films that talk about modern problems. I just think there's a modern consciousness. There's a addressing of these things we get now that we just haven't seen in cinema for a long time. And it's amazing that these conversations are breaking through into like the national consciousness, largely unaided by the incredible power of storytelling in cinema. It's like cinema could do a lot to help the world here. So I hope this is just one in a long string of movies that address this this sort of rich area for storytelling that is all of these insane problems we're living with.
We have a website. That's doublefeature.fm. And then we have the Patreon, which is patreon.com/doublefeature, which is the thing I wanted to talk about. So clearly we're having a hard time wrapping up our Cisco double feature. And anybody who's been playing along will also remember that we had a difficult time doing the same thing with Los Angeles, New York City, and Austin, Texas. One of the things I proposed last show is that if people give to the Patreon enough for us to do another additional content episode, I think it would be very helpful for us to literally triangulate these cities by doing one more film from each of the four cities on a single additional content show. So it'd be sort of like a triple feature, quadruple feature on double feature.
It sounds complicated, but the long and short of it is you're right. These shows all felt like we just got started. We have so much more to talk about. They're just very, very, very dense topics, and I love considering cities and episodes like this. Really enjoyed this for pairing. So yeah, patreon.com/doublefeature. A big thanks to Charles Crawford, Ben Ecker, Ross Mahler, and Joachim Vernon, who are executive producers of our show. They know about the Patreon. Why don't you join us over there?
Yeah, it's super fun.
Films.
The Piano Teacher and L.
For next time.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the battleship Pretension Fleet.